I've been talking about, we've got four things we're looking at, peace in the just community, peace in politics, peace in creation, peace and resurrection. And one of the obvious things I'm trying to show us is all these things are places where we're supposed to be bringing a different kind of lifestyle, a different approach to life. And I just noticed I forgot, there are two things I wanted to bring in before I shift over to peace and creation. And one of them is a quote from, I was bringing in some things that happened in the state of Kansas, and I want to read a quote from one of your sons, Irvin Stutzman. He wrote a book called From Non-Resistance to Justice, and it's about how the larger Mennonite church, the more liberal one, shifted from a non-resistant position like I'm talking to you about, and gradually went to a position of emphasizing justice. And that is inevitably going to mean getting, becoming participants in the political realm. And just want to read this just so you can see how things shifted. It's now your judgment. Is that a good thing or not? You could probably guess what my judgment would be. Brown's statement, now this was something that was written in the Gospel Herald in 1976 about why he participated in a continental walk for the for disarmament and social justice. His statement in the Gospel Herald pointed to a growing conviction among Mennonites that justice must precede peace. Justice must precede peace. Ideologically, peace was seen as the product or result of social justice. It was the argument often made by the theorists of the just war theory. Now think about that. This idea represented a transformation of thought for Mennonite peacemakers concerned for social responsibility. Whereas peacemakers in an earlier era might have worked for justice, now justice makers would work for peace. And what I think he's getting at there is formerly we emphasized peace and trying to make peace and using that as a way to bring justice rather than enforcing justice. But this new, the justice makers are trying to enforce justice, hoping that will bring peace. Justice was increasingly portrayed as an ultimate value. The significance of this transformation comes to the fore in a consideration of social revolution against unjust regimes. If justice is perceived as the ultimate value, violence may be justified as a means to that justice, to that end. In contrast, if peace is seen as an ultimate value, both as an end and as a means, then justice may be achieved only by nonviolent means, such as active nonviolent resistance, suffering, martyrdom, or the power of radical love. Well, I don't agree with Brother Stutzman on the possibility of using nonviolent resistance. And I think that that's a mistake. But anyway, he's pointing out a change that happened. And the change led the Mennonite Church to think that it's okay to become involved in politics and to try to use our influence to force people to be just. So this is a way many non-resistant people have gone. That church shifted totally from non-resistance to wanting to enforce justice and then hope that would bring peace. And I see that as a faulty way of proceeding. The only other issue that I wanted to bring up was to think about it. If you had been in government, let's say at 9/11, when the Muslim radicals hijacked some planes and ran them into or flew them into the trade towers and the Pentagon. If you had been in government then, what would you have done if you had been a non-resistant Christian? Because if those of you that are old enough remember that time, and almost everybody's feelings were inflamed. And so I just want us to see that there's a very different way of moving ahead if we want to use politics or if we want to use the non-resistant route, the route of bringing people to Jesus. We are also called to be people of the creation, that care for the creation. And I don't have it up there, but the two verses I want to think of first are Genesis 1:26 and then 2:15. And they tell us that God made us in his image, which we already heard about today and how important that is, and that he gave Adam and Eve dominion over all the other creatures that he had made. And then the second verse says, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it. And I think that's all I want to read on that. But God made us as the stewards of this wonderful, beautiful creation he's given us to live in. And so that's the first point about creation. We are meant to be stewards of it. Sometimes I think we may forget that. I think we've got a pretty good record. I know that our people in Europe were known for the way they took care of the land. And a lot of us are known for that as well in this day and age here. My only caution would be, let's not let the pressures drive us in the wrong direction as we take care of the land because of economics. And I know I'm not a farmer, so it's easy for me to say that. But I really want us to try to continue that tradition of caring well for what God has given us, for being good stewards of the land. But it also goes beyond that, I'd say, and that is, we can look at Romans 8. And it's a long passage, so I'm not going to read it, but it says, it tells us that we are in a time of suffering, and there's something coming that's so grand and wonderful that we should not let that cause us to be discouraged. One of these days, it's going to be revealed, the sons of God are going to be revealed. And then I'm going to start reading at verse 20. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. But not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit. So we ourselves who are saved, who have the Spirit in us, we are not experiencing all of what we're going to as far as the release from this the curse of sin yet. We haven't experienced that yet. But anyway, we are going to. So anyway, we also groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for the adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. Who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. We are the stewards of this creation, but we also have to recognize that the creation is not the way it was meant to be, and that causes certain problems. And we have to think about creative ways while the creation is still under this bondage that we can use it, and I would even say that we could free it. And to some degree, we are not the ones who are going to free it. And yet, we should be thinking about how we can make things better, even for creation. So creation is under bondage at this point. It's to help us come to the Lord. And both of us, creation and we humans who have turned to God, are eventually going to experience a full restoration. That comes in the resurrection. So all of these things, we should be a just community. We're called to that, and this is one way we bring peace into the world. We live in a world that puts the emphasis on politics. We need to put it on being peaceful people or peaceable people who come up with different kinds of solutions, not the kinds of solutions that politics give. Sometimes we have failed in this. I could give you some examples of that. In other words, not something political, but I'll just give you one thing that I know that happened in Virginia. In Virginia, this is in the early 1900s, as more Mennonites started sharing the faith, many people came to the faith who were not from our background, black people as well as white. And a big question came up. This is Virginia, and Virginia is a southern state, and the southern states at this time had a lot of prejudice in them. And so questions came up about, do we share the common cup, and do we give the kiss of peace? I'm sorry to say that. It makes me embarrassed. But that actually happened, and it's not a political thing, but we let a political situation, a state that was segregated and and the people in the state mostly were segregationists, at least at that time, we let that shape us, and we were unjust. And it was in a church situation. It wasn't something political. So we need to recognize that we have something to do in each one of these situations. In politics, it's to be a light and to show a different way. With creation, we've done a pretty good job. We have tried to take care of it as God has told us to. Maybe we need to think even more about ways that we can, we can't get it out of its bondage, and yet it does seem to me that we can think of ways that make the experience of creation, if you want to call it that, better than it has been. And so that's something for us to think about. How can we make the created world better? One way that hits me, and Christians were very active in this in the early days of conservation, is supporting conservation issues. So Christians were very involved in the beginning of the national forests and national parks. They saw that these areas with their pristine nature without the mark of man ought to be preserved. And so they were active in helping that come to be. And I think that was a good way to try to help nature a little bit get out from that bondage, because man abusing nature is a kind of that bondage, and the willingness to set aside places and save them, let them be the way they are without the touch of man, I think would be a part of helping nature. But the final one is the resurrection. In Romans 8, it does tell us that what we're looking for is the redemption of our bodies. And so that is referring to the resurrection. It also tells us in chapter 3 of Acts, this is a sermon that Paul gave. And in that sermon, he says that what we're looking, if you turn to God because of what Jesus has done, we can expect him to return. And one of these days, when he does return, he's going to restore all things. And that really is our final hope. We should be doing whatever we can to bring peace in all these areas, at church, in our local community, even among our friends who are very active in politics, trying to help them see that this isn't the thing that's going to bring real solution and real peace. As we take care of creation, the thing that's going to finally change this is the final day, the day that Jesus returns. And on that day, he is going to restore all of creation, and he's going to restore us. He's going to raise us from the dead. And Paul tells us that if this isn't true, then our faith is useless. If all we have to be thankful for is what we experience now, then our faith really isn't any good. But if Jesus really did die for our sins and rise again, then we can expect that's going to happen for us. And that is the final thing that will be bring peace and real justice. Even we Christians can't always figure out what's right to do in a particular situation, or we don't always agree together anyway. When this day comes, we will be different. We will be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And Christ himself is going to be the judge and make set everything right. This needs to be our hope. And this will, if this is our hope, then it helps us approach these other things with patience, with a willingness to be frustrated sometimes, but always looking for the path that God wants us to follow. That's what I have. I would like to hear your thoughts, and if you have questions, but I would like to hear your thoughts. How are we supposed to live in a world that thinks politics is the thing that makes the solutions? How are we supposed to be a just community in this world? How do we live in creation? So I'd like to hear from you. I'm giving you maybe the more abstract stuff, but let's talk about it. So how can we make these things real? What are some suggestions that you have? Mm-hmm. Thank you, Nathan. There's so many things you could say, and one of them is we should be careful about, are we just passive? Now, there's a time to be passive. Jesus was passive. He laid his life down. And there may be a time for you to be passive, but perhaps you're suggesting we're too passive, right, Nathan? Can be. Mm-hmm. And I'm agreeing with you, and I think that what I'm trying to suggest is that we figure out how we share the good thing we have. Not necessarily, this isn't calling us to some kind of radical change about how we're doing things. In fact, it's about sharing with others the good that we have. But we need to be active. We need to really figure out how to do this. And I think this can vary from community to community. And so I don't think we can come up with some suggestions or concrete ideas that everybody's going to do. But we do need to come up with some. And so you're saying that these small things is a place to start, I think. Right, Nathan? Are these small things a place to start?
Yes.
Yeah.
You mentioned, for example, within a abortion.
Yeah.
In the fundamental Christian world, you know, people have take a strong stand against abortion. And so if we say in that area, or whether it's in fighting human trafficking or you name it, mm-hmm. or it can be local, small things, that we say we don't get involved to try to politically legislate those things, that we show that we are willing to get really dirty and to mm-hmm. get involved in bringing redemption in those areas. Mm-hmm.
And to give a little bit of encouragement, you guys do that with disaster relief. I liked what you said, get dirty and do something. It's not like we don't do that, but perhaps we ought to be thinking about doing it in other ways, in broader ways. Anybody else?
I'm not sure where this fits, but I have just been deeply impressed with the way that our God is a God who cares for widows and orphans, and he gets really upset when we don't do that. And so I think God's character is something that motivates us and gives us direction about mm-hmm. what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know how this fits, but I've been thinking about that, and I mention it now.
Mm-hmm. those are people that part of the structure in their lives fell away. So that's a very important place. One thing that didn't exist in the days the Bible was written is the kind of prisons we have. And one thing that I've also seen us do, I think, well in, is going into the prisons and loving those men and women. But I think we probably need to do a little bit more with halfway houses or inviting them into our homes when they come out. But we've done some, we see there's a loss of structure there, and that means it's going to be a really difficult, it's going to be a messy situation. But yeah, just like widows and orphans, that's another place to think about, and I think a lot of us are doing that.
This morning you taught us that we were created in the image of God. We're given personal choice. And then this evening you spoke about how the using coercion to try and force the Christian's values on the non-Christian, how that is a form of coercion. Mm-hmm. Are you suggesting by that we are violating the very principle of personal rights that God has given other
people? Oh, you mean when we try to impose?
Right.
All I was saying at that point was we're Americans, and that's one of our strong beliefs, that nobody can violate me and I have these rights. So I was really thinking of it from a political position, mm-hmm. and that's what angered these people so much. So what are you thinking of there?
Well, I'm just wondering if in doing that, the pressure we put on them to try, we were actually violating their personal rights.
Oh, yes, yes.
And in that respect, we were tampering with something that God had given them, mm-hmm. and they can choose those things. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, they'll pay for it.
Yes.
But we can't change that for them. That has to eventually be, it has to be a choice of their own.
Yeah, we can't force that change. I agree with that. And it doesn't fit the Christian model at all, to make that approach. And I did that. And often when I think about it, it's just with shame. It was a way I actually made it harder for a lot of people to think about what they were doing. It became an angry thing, and this guy is running roughshod over me. Anybody else? Gary.
Well, this shifts the question to something else that's almost trivial maybe, but on Irvin Stutzman's book, I haven't read it, so now I'm wondering if I have the wrong impression. I thought Irvin may not have been giving an argument for the switch from non-resistance to justice, but was rather decrying the shift.
Is that the
thesis of his book?
I think he was a bit more ambiguous than that. Actually, huh?
Well, I'm just asking. So
go ahead.
I hear others say.
Yeah, I think it was ambiguous. I was just reading that to show you the change that did happen. And he recognized that very clearly. I actually talked to him about it, and it's been a while. I think he is more ambiguous, though. I mean, I think he didn't resist it anyway. That I'm sure of. Anything else?
I'm wondering if you want to address the civil rights movement and how it used nonviolence. You touched on it just a little bit. Do you want to highlight that more or not?
Yeah, that'd be worth talking about. I don't think coercion is ever, whether it's nonviolent or not, is ever the Christian approach. Now, I really do like... I much prefer what was happening in the civil rights movement under Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. than what has happened since. It's become extremely, it's become a power play for leaders. And I honestly think that Dr. Martin Luther King did not mean it to go that way. Now, having said that, he actually considered non-resistance in his earlier years, and then he read, I think, Gandhi and some others, and came to the conclusion that that wouldn't work, and that what we should do instead is non-violent resistance. So we should push for change, we should resist the bad things. There is a place for resistance. Paul says we should obey God rather than man. My question is, how do you do it? Do you do it by marches, or should we have treated the blacks that came into the church just like ourselves? Now, the thing that made in Virginia that made us not do it, I think, if I understand the situation right, was fear about how the community would see that. That's where we should have resisted. So there is a place for resistance, but the nonviolent resistance is an attempt to force. It's still a coercive thing. And what I would call us to do, I think we should go against the culture. We should. We talked about that this morning. But it should be, we should be a sign of what is right. And whenever, just like my trying to force those ladies not to have an abortion, whenever you try to force the right thing on somebody, it backfires and it makes them angry. And they don't hear what you want them to hear. So, but having said that, I was talking to some friends recently and just mourning that Dr. King had been killed, and mourning for the direction that the civil rights movement took after that, which the best way I can, what it looks like to me is that those leaders that were under him started using it for their own power. And I don't think he would have done that, but I still don't like what he was doing. And I wish that more of us would have figured out ways to, even just going to a black church back then would have been, we should have done that. We should have gone to black churches. We should have invited them to our, we should have had picnics together. You know what I'm saying? Go ahead.
So we have an issue with poverty now.
Uh-huh.
Does that mean we should be looking to get involved in the same way? And I'm not suggesting that it wasn't an issue back then, but I'm saying we're becoming aware of that,
yeah,
because of some of the social issues that have come up recently.
Well, we need to think of creative ways that we can help build structure. Well, first of all, let's never forget that the social gospel isn't the first thing. The gospel is the first thing. Jesus is the first thing. And so with bringing Jesus to these people, this is what I was trying to say about prisoners. I learned firsthand that they can turn to Jesus, but then they don't know how to hold their job down. And we need to help them do that. So with poverty, what I would say is we need to think creatively. And I love history and I'm kind of a dreamer. And so I'm not as exactly the right person to namely say what we should do, but in the details. But it seems to me we should think about how to help these people come to Jesus and build the things into them that are missing. I think those two things have to go together. And maybe we haven't had enough vision about how damaged people are when they live a life of poverty or when they live in a single mother home or something like that. Just leave it with Daryl for a while.
I promise this will be my last one. I read a book recently that talked about how important it is to get close to wherever the bad is that you're trying to fix. And it strikes me that especially with non-resistance or the doctrine of love, we need to get close to them in some form or another.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
since poverty out here in the country is rarer mm-hmm. than it is in the city, I think that has some implications about where we should choose to live. And I'm saying this as a person who lives 20 miles west of here where there aren't people.
Yeah.
I'm feeling convicted about that.
That's really good. But there are, okay, some of us just couldn't even imagine going to the city. There are poor rural areas too. So I like what you're saying. And I really admire, I don't know, I can't think right now, is there anybody from this church that's either in Iraq or Jordan right now? Is there anybody? Well, I know.
Okay.
Okay, from this area. Okay, that's what you just asked for. That's people going. It's not safe there. And I remember when Donovan and I went to Israel, he went to learn the language because he wanted to read the Bible in the Old Testament in Hebrew, and I went to write a book on non-resistance. And his parents didn't want him to go by himself, so he asked me to go along. We went over. Before we left, we kept getting these questions. Aren't you afraid? And people would tell us, don't ride on the buses, because at that particular time, a lot of people were doing suicide bombings on buses. Well, you can't live that way. So we went over there, and we walked. We walked because it was cheap. If you don't know Donovan, if you know Donovan, you'll know what I'm talking about. No, it was me too. It was me too. So, but whenever anybody would visit us, we'd buy a pile of tickets and we'd take them on the bus because it's the quickest way to get around. And we were living in a place, I would walk through Arab areas and I had stones thrown at me and I had words thrown at me which I couldn't understand, but I think I heard the message in the tone. And I looked like a Jew, so I know what was going on. Donovan, on the other hand, looked like an Arab, and he didn't get in trouble in the Arab parts of town, which is where I got in trouble. He got in trouble in the Jewish parts. It was so funny. We were going into this bus station, and so they bring the crowd down to a one-person file, you know, one behind the other. And I was behind Donovan, and pretty soon there was a guy with a gun. I don't know if he was a policeman or a soldier. And I said, Donovan, he's looking at you. And he said, I know. And as soon as he got there, I think he asked him in Arab a question, Arabic. And Donovan said, I don't understand. And right away, here's an English speaker with an American accent. And so he was always very quickly taken care of, either because of the way he spoke or his passport. But he was harassed because he looked like an Arab by Jews, and I was harassed by Arabs because I looked like a Jew. And okay, you go to a place like that and you just ask God, but you also need to be willing. This is a risk, and I mentioned that we've got to risk. So I'm really, really proud of the people who are going over there. One, there's a couple, Kevin Smokers, who went through the program, who are in Syria, they're in Jordan, working with Syrian refugees, and the Yoder fellow whose wife died, Tamil. I can't get his first name.
Daryl.
Daryl Yoder is remarried, and he and his wife are in Iraq. And so, there are probably others that I'm just not thinking about. And I just really admire them. And that's a pattern for us. So it's not the only thing to do. But you were talking about getting, well, I've heard get your hands dirty, and I heard, whether you use the word or not, you know, taking a chance, going somewhere where it's not comfortable for us. And I want to see more of that. And I want us to be committed to who we are as well, because that's part of what these people need. They don't have to become exactly like us, but they need structure. They need somebody who gives them a model of how you live the Christian life. Yeah, back there.
So it's easy to feel more noble being willing to give up our lives.
Mm-hmm.
In going to dangerous places. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about dangerous things we experience here. If truly we are willing to get dirty and interact with people and situations that are messy, how do we go about doing that, meeting people where they are in their circumstances, and calling people to light and being salt and light, rather than being reduced to things we don't want?
Well, that's where that's going to maybe vary from one community to another, and that's where I'm thinking we need to think constructively or creatively. What could we do? Because I think some of it you ought to do as a group, and then some of it might be some of you get together and start a church in rural Mississippi or in Memphis, the city of Memphis. But then there are other things that you can do while you're here as a group, as a church, and where you can support each other, and it's not just a one-person effort. And I think you're probably doing some of those things. Didn't I hear something about some kind of church happening outside of our regular, for young people or children or something? Did I hear something about that? Am I... What is it? Huh?
Rise Church, they call it. It's a children and kids church.
Okay. Okay. That strikes me as a thing that I'm suggesting. I don't know what you're doing, but when I was in VS in Reading, I worked with guys in that came out of prison. But I went to a Mennonite church that was trying to do outreach and in the city. And one of the biggest things they were doing was working with young people. And my own experience, and I've heard this more often, it seemed that once they became 16, they stopped coming. And I think the mistake maybe was not working with the parents as well, trying to get the parents to come. But even if you couldn't get them to come, you still have to work with the children. But it sounds to me like you're doing some of those things. But you know your situation here better than I do, so that's what you should be doing. Figuring, do you have any thoughts on what maybe you guys could do here? Do you have? Yeah.
So certainly there are different opinions about what levels of risk and safety we're comfortable with, and coming out of a conversation several of us had a couple of evenings ago, an idea that's been stirring with me is being deliberate and willing to go into dangerous and messy situations, but being deliberate and willing to not go alone. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's with somebody else physically present, maybe it's accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not thinking as much in terms of physical safety as in shift in idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And okay. How we think. And yeah. I think we need to be open to learning from other people and learning from situations. But absolutely, there are dangers that we want to be awake to.
Okay, I hadn't really thought about that other side of it. But that's what I meant when I said, but we've got something and let's hold on to it. Doesn't mean it won't be shaped a little different because of some kind of circumstances. So, but that thing about the danger of going into these places and the kind, I guess the kind of temptations that could be there that you're not normally used to, is that part of what you were thinking of or not? Not that. Okay. Well, I really appreciate it. I think this is something we have to do. Most of this stuff is something we have to do at least with some others. So that I really affirm that. Anything else? Do the ladies have anything over here? While they're passing that over, I'll go ahead. Whoever want it. While they're passing that over, I just want to tell you, ladies, how important you are. God made male and female because we don't see things the same way. And I remember, for those of you who know Irvin Hershberger, he was the deacon at the church I joined when I was 21. And I remember some of his sermons. And one of them that I remember was he took a cup with a handle on it, and he said, you know, if I hold it this way, this is how a man sees it. And I don't know if the handle was there or not. Then he turned it the other way, and he said, this is the way a woman sees it. And so without both of us, you don't get the whole story. And that sunk deep. So I would like to hear at least one thing from you. And you have to give feedback into these guys because they don't see everything. Go ahead. Oh, they have one over here. Well, I think maybe somebody, okay, whatever you want to do, I don't care.
Well, it doesn't have to be now. You you had said to remind you about non-combatant military service.
Okay.
This evening.
And your question was about, say specifically what your question was.
Well, I was wrestling with the thing of, you know, back in the early church, how they could serve in the way that seemed like comparable to non-combatant service today.
I see.
And just was, yeah.
Okay. Right down there. While that's being passed over, I will say something on that. In our circles, there have been different approaches. Now, I know where I stand, and I think every community ought to figure out where it stands. And I think it's inappropriate for us to take non-combatant service in the military. It looks contradictory to those outside, I think you're still helping the war effort too much. However, not everybody's going to see it that way, and I know some very admirable stories of young men during the Vietnam War, young Mennonite men, who became medics and were on the front line risking their lives. And one of the things that happened, at least sometimes, was they would help the enemy if he was wounded, and they'd help an American if he was wounded. And some of them said they thought they were being shot at from the wrong side when they were helping the enemy. I can admire that, but I still think that is a mistake. Now, there are other people who say that we, by signing up for the draft, are going too far. And there are some who say, I won't sign up for the draft. I think every community has to wrestle through this. When President Carter reinstated the draft, that's when I was in VS in Reading. And I was the head of the unit there, and all the unit heads working for Lancaster Conference met together somewhere in the South, I forget where it was. And one of the guys I knew, because he was the best friend of the son of a woman that I rented a place from when I taught school in Lancaster. And so I knew him. I knew who he was, and he was my friend's best friend, and I knew where he stood. And one of the things, so President Carter was calling on all of us to sign up, and most of our people would have said, "Do it, cooperate. This is something we can cooperate with." Here's the question: where do you draw the line? And my friend said, "He's not going to sign. It's not my friend. He was my landlady's son's friend." And he said, I'm not going to sign up. And I argued with him about it. I felt that it was not going too far. But I also admired his willingness he was willing to take the consequences. And I told him, if you don't sign up, and if the government comes after you, and if you go to jail, I will be one of the first people to come visit you. I won't agree with you, but I would visit him because he may have had a little bit of a disagreement with me. We were pretty close, though, in where we were at, and he was in a slightly different place, and I think it's right to support somebody like that. Understandably, it's not. There may be some times when it isn't, but I felt like I would want to support him in his decision, though I was trying to help him see that wasn't necessary, not from my perspective. So the thing about where to draw the line is there are ambiguities, and I think it works best when we as a people together figure out that here at Center we're going to do this. And I do think, though, you should support that guy who says, I want to go further, at least if he doesn't violate something in the scriptures. And I didn't feel this fellow was doing that.
It's on. Okay. My thought has been that there's sometimes when conservative, and I consider myself conservative, can go so far that it touches the left. I mean, mm-hmm. There's things that we touch on both the same concerns. Do you have any thoughts on how we can use discernment? Because I think some of the agendas in the world are different than ours. Mm-hmm. How do we use discernment to decide what the motivations are and how do we, when we're supportive of particular things. And maybe I'm thinking more of like the evangelical left.
Uh-huh.
And how do we, because some of the language is the same. Mm-hmm. And I think you made a point about us being just versus identifying with coercing.
Coercing, yeah.
Yeah.
And so you were asking about discernment.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, you bring up an interesting point, and it's not, though, just when you look at the political realm, it's not just on the left. And on the left, there are things we agree with, or we should. And as you point out, there's an evangelical left, and they sound a lot like what I was saying, but not quite the same thing, because they do want to use the government's coercion to do the good things. But it's on the other side, too. And maybe that's our temptation even more, is on the right side, it's, some of that sounds so good. But I think what we have to recognize when it comes to politics, that we can't agree with fully with either side. And so my question would be, as far as discernment, I think that would be one thing to try to do, to see that what so-and-so wants to do over here, and I don't agree with him or her, this politician, or this Christian who's politically involved. Well, what is good there? Or even just a politician, what is good there? But also, what do I disagree with? But then look over here, and think about all of the anger that's between these two different sides. And I think we can use discernment to see that we don't disagree with either completely with either side, but I don't agree with either side as well. So is it the place, is a thing like that where we want to go to accomplish good, or is it even possible to? So I think it's valuable to recognize there's some good things over here and good things over here, but I would encourage us to try to help that person on either side, the right or the left, to recognize that what they're going for, at least in these certain places, is really good, but is it the way to make that happen lastingly? That's what I would wonder about, or what I'd bring to them. But for myself, I would say, I can recognize the good on both sides, but I want all the good. And for that, I think we need to, as a church, there's where we need to discern. What should we do? How can we get the good over here and the good over here in a way that people want it, that they don't have to have it forced on them? So I don't know fully, but it's a good insight in that there's real truth in among the political people, but is that the way to get what we want? Is there somebody else?
This is getting real practical to that question, and I just really appreciate that emphasis. So those most of us here in the building would know of the Native American couple that lives in the community. And we know that there's some of these issues that are really emotionally charged. Mm-hmm. And I just wish that most of us could have the opportunity to talk with, to hear the fears and the struggles mm-hmm. they face,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
whether we agree with them or not.
Mm-hmm.
But if I would have had to take a political side when talking with him, I would have been defeated.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I was safe with us both coming to Christ
mm-hmm.
and refusing mm-hmm. to take stands.
Yes.
And to show that's not right. It's a call to us, what you were telling, just affirming mm-hmm. that, and how mm-hmm. important it is as a community we go the second and the third and the fourth mile.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. And see, that's the kind of thing I don't know about. That what kind of situations you have here. But one thing that I could suggest to you that I think we have a little bit of an in with, and that's get to know some Muslims. I don't know if there are any in Hutchinson, But there got to be some in Wichita. And do any of you raise goats or sheep? Well, let them know that you have goats and sheep to sell, and then invite them in to eat and talk with them. So this fits with what you're saying. We've got this open, and we are modest people. We can tell them, we can let them know we're never in the Crusades. That's a helpful little clue for them to find out about, and things like that. So I really like that, and I don't know if any of you are trying to reach them, but that would be one thing that I would suggest fits with what you're saying. And with Christ, we can come together. I'll just share again from that experience in Israel. If I didn't already think this way, that really drove me to exactly that. We saw how the Arab people were treated in Jerusalem, and it wasn't nice. They were stopped all the time, and we knew it because Donovan was stopped for a while. We finally found out how to fix that, but anyway. And one time my dad's second wife asked me, she said she heard that Jerusalem is the safest city in the world. You live there. What do you think? And I said, I thought for a little bit, and I said, well, I saw women by themselves with their strollers at midnight going through the streets and not worried, at least some of the streets. And so you could get this sense that it's really a safe place. But I said, I've been in all parts of the place, and I've seen a lot of things more than just ladies with their strollers at midnight. And I said, I haven't been in a city that I sense the anger and the hatred so much. But it's screwed down so tight because the Israelis have the police and they have all kinds of military. When there was a festival, when there was a Muslim festival, all of a sudden a new kind of military person would show up I had never seen before. So I don't know how many different kinds of military they have, but they had their police. And they would be in the Arab parts of the city with their guns. And then when a festival would come up, there'd be all these other people that would show up with their guns. And if you were a school group wanting to go somewhere for an informative trip, there had to be two, this is for Jewish children, you had to have two adults with guns. So if you saw a bunch of children walking through the town, like on a school day, there was going to be probably somebody at the front and the back, adults with guns on their backs. Now, there was a reason for that, but I'm just telling you how much anger and hatred and fear was there. And the only thing that's going to help that is Jesus. And so whatever peace plan President Trump comes up with, it may help the situation some, but it's a real willingness to reconcile. That's the only thing that's going to help. And I don't think it can come. Individually, it could come with some people that get to know, one Arab gets to know a Jew, and that there may be reconciliation without Jesus. But I don't think it's the deepest reconciliation. And I think the reconciliation they need in Israel is they need Jesus. So I like what you said. Anything else?
Is this on?
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll share a little just because Paul is encouraging me to. I've been fairly reserved in talking about details, but I think it fits well now. I do raise sheep. I raise the kind of sheep they really like. I've been establishing some friendships that are very enjoyable. Mm-hmm. It's not just a matter of mm-hmm. putting up with it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in a prophet. But I'm also willing to go out of my way. Last Saturday, it didn't suit me to go out and corral the sheep.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, I called him back and I said, I just can't do this today. And he said, Joe, I have to have one today. And so I did. He talked me into it. Well, there were three of them that got out of the car. And they were just jabbering immediately. They were so excited about, this is their first time. And they discovered very quickly that I have close ties to the Amish,
mm-hmm.
and they were really excited about that. They see a similarity.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a connection that caused an instant friendship. In fact, one of them said, I want to marry an Amish girl. Will you take me?
Volunteers?
Will you take me to meet some Amish people? I said, sometime I will. But I said, no, Muslims and Amish don't mix in that way. We had a good time.
Mm-hmm.
2 weeks ago, my daughter's friend and my grandson and I went out where they were actually having a little feast at our cabin. They discovered we have a cabin, and I let them use that. And we went out. They were very happy to have us join them and just sit in the circle with them,
mm-hmm.
and chit chat, and so they're enjoyable to be with. I just mm-hmm. want to encourage you to see them that way.
Mm-hmm. I don't know personally as much about the inside we have with Muslims. I know a little bit about it from having a friend in Chris Stolzfus who really gets into Muslim evangelism. But we do have, sometimes they know things about, they know what kind of people we are. I know personally that if you meet a really, really conservative Jew, they often also recognize some kind of similarity between us and them. And often they know that we weren't in the Inquisitions and we weren't in the Crusades as well. And so our non-resistance there is a plus, and our modesty is a plus. And I remember telling a Jewish guy, I said, you know, I've never been to it. I've been to synagogues many times now, but this was before. I said, I've never been to a synagogue. Where are you guys from? And they were really cautious. And finally I said, yeah, I understand your caution. And then I told him, I'm Amish Mennonite, and we never did anything against you. And he actually knew what that meant, and he said, but you've got a mustache. And so I told him, well, I know a little bit about Jews, and there's a lot of range there, and we have that too. So so anyway, yeah, really, who we are is not a stumbling block, or it shouldn't be. Anybody else? Don't want to go too long. Well, unless you do. Did I see a hand back there? Apparently not. Is there anybody on this side again? Yeah, right back there.
Well, with being involved in the perspectives class, I think I'm becoming to understand how we are a distinct people group. And I think we perceive are distinct ways as barriers,
mm-hmm.
and they aren't always mm-hmm. that way. Mm-hmm. And so that's been an encouragement for me to reaching out, mm-hmm. to not see my distinctive ways as a barrier,
mm-hmm.
and to try to more intentionally ask them
mm-hmm.
what they need, what they want.
Mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm. And with that barrier issue, okay, let's face it, with the average American culture, it could be. We need to think about ways to talk to them that are good ways to talk to them. I often take my students to a Catholic church, and I think it was about the last time. I want them to see how our forefathers worshiped 500 years ago. Everybody was Catholic, so I wanted to see that. And then the priest at this church really liked it when I brought my students, and so he asked for us to eat together, and he wanted his young people to hear the kinds of questions our people would ask, because they won't think about those things. You know, so we're there, it's strange to us, so we ask these questions, and he wanted his young people to hear this, because they'd never think this way. Well, after we did our thing and we were getting ready to leave, a young girl said to me, well, what are the differences? And I confess to my ignorance and stupidity, but well, I was trying to be just, I don't know everything I said, but the thing that struck me was, and I said, we believe in modesty. Mm. And I'm modest, and I don't know if I would quite agree with her, but what it made me see was, you know, she's in a setting, and in that setting, there is a sort of expectation, and she's used to it. And I realized after that, I don't think she was really modest, but I think I have to be careful about how I talk about it to not build an unnecessary barrier there and to help. So that's just another side of that story. But yes, with Jewish, conservative Jews, conservative Muslims, and in fact, a lot of the third world, it's not a barrier. Anything else? Okay, I'll turn it back over to you then.